Welcome to the airport lounge. Table for two gentlemen? Right this way. Here's your booth. Have a great show.
Welcome to the Airport Lounge, the Winnipeg Jets podcast. Much like the Jets game day experience, not that entertaining. I'm Mike Guthrie, and I'm joined by my good friend and 323rd in line to be the next head coach of the Winnipeg Jets, Vaughn Mitchell. How's it going, Vaughn?
Well, I got to tell you, Mike, all the recent events around the Jets have made me feel young again. Friday was a big day, a day of excitement, kind of like the day of a big dance back in high school. And like high school, the day started with a lot of promise and positive expectations. Maybe something good would finally happen. Then, at the event, there wasn't a lot of activity and mostly just a lot of standing around. By the end of the night, not much had changed, and there I was, once again a loser, because the prettiest girl at the dance, named Victory, had left the building with someone else.
That was an intricate ballet, my friend. Well done. You really, I was like, where is he going? There it is.
I know. There it is. Yeah. Oh, it had an appropriate denouement, like a Seinfeld episode.
I can very much relate, though, to the high school dance analogy. That was perfect. It brings back fond, but sometimes scarring memories.
Friday was quite the day, like, all jokes aside. I mean, this thing drops, you know, just before about 10 a.m., because I was just about to go on a staff call.
Yeah.
Shout out to my work colleagues, by the way, who learned on Friday that I have a Winnipeg Jets podcast. So they have that
to promote, buddy.
Yeah, they have that to hold against me now. So to this point, I've been keeping it pretty quiet. I mean, they're all highly educated and accomplished people, and I didn't want to give them any additional material for them to hold against me. I mean, my regular work speaks for itself in that regard. But... Which brought? Are we on Overcast? They were saying that's where all the cool kids have their podcasts. Are we also?
If that's where the cool kids are, then we're definitely not there.
Yes.
I will readily admit that I don't know. I mean, we signed up as I think we've alluded to several times, is that neither Vaughn nor I have an expertise in technology and apparently promotion.
Because yes.
You're just telling your work colleagues we have a podcast now. I'm going to say yes, because we're on everything basically that'll play a podcast. So I'm certain we're on that.
Awesome.
Although I have no idea what that is.
So obviously anyone who's listening to this knows the big news on Friday was that Paul Maurice resigned his position as head coach of the Winnipeg Jets. So that drops, and for me, I thought it was fake. So things explode on my phone, as you would think they would. You know, anyone that knows me, that knows my love for the Jets, we were, like, our group was going back and forth. It was all over the place. And then you really felt this, you know, profound lifting of... a dark cloud a little bit, like, hey, here we go. We have a game tonight. It's Friday night. I don't know, for a duo that has been very clear on how they feel about Paul Maurice.
Yeah.
I don't know how more excited you could be other than with this all happening. I mean, so it was very, when all was said and done, it ended up being very, very strange because the game fell flat on its face. I mean, what was the day like for you, Mike?
Right. Well, I had many people, and I have to think I have to do a little self-reflection, because many of the messages I received were like, I bet you're happy now.
Yeah.
How happy are you? And which leads me to believe that people think I revel in schadenfreude, because I haven't been quiet whatsoever about my feelings about Paul Maurice and the fact that I think he should no longer be the coach of the Winnipeg Jets. But I do think, and had thought of it, it was clear that he's a good dude. He seems like a nice guy. He seems like an intelligent man. And he seems affable by all accounts. And so I don't, you know, that aspect of it, him losing his job, is not something that I took any personal satisfaction from. But I was happy. I was happy for the team and for the organization, for the Winnipeg Jets, the team I love and cheer for every game. And I think it's probably a year or two, and we'll get into it later, than it probably should have been. But I did get a lot of reach outs to say, well, there you go. You got your wish. Because I do have a number of people in my life who are not ardent, but are very supportive of Paul Maurice and don't view him as the issue that we do. And so there was a lot of, well, fine. Now the Jets better win 20 in a row.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you're wrong, Mike. And I completely disagree with that notion. But it was something where, you know, I think he was a decent to good head coach. You know, winning percentage was about in the 57%. He was 315, 223, and 62 over 9 seasons. And, you know, we made the playoffs 5 out of the 8 years. We advanced to the Western Conference Final. All things not to disregard in their entirety. But Maurice said it. He's like, I've reached the pinnacle of where I can push and take this team.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not, you know, it's not maybe a case of them tuning me out in the dressing room, but whatever I'm doing, it's not working.
Yeah.
And my biggest thing is kudos to him. I thought he left with class and with self-awareness, but not tail between the legs. I thought he handled it perfectly, and so he deserves full credit for that, because it doesn't sound to me, or it didn't sound to me, that the organization itself was pushing him out. I do believe that this was a matter of him realizing that he wasn't maximizing the opportunity of the team, and therefore he no longer wanted to do it, and so he deserves credit for that.
Yeah, you know, I want to look at it in as positive a light as I can without being too sycophantic, right? So I do think that people should realize things that you and I have been saying for quite some time. Paul Maurice himself effectively confirmed in the press conference.
Right.
You know, he basically admitted he doesn't have what it takes to take the team to the next level. I mean, he explicitly said that. And that's been our argument. Not that, you know, over and above everything else, as you described, we didn't think that he believed in a brand of hockey and a deployment of resources that best fit this group and would take this group to the next level, okay? And that's what he said, that he no longer has the internal drive nor the strategic and tactical ability to push this team. Because I do think it's more than, it is more than just pushing buttons. I can't push their buttons. It is way more than that. It is more than that. It is more than simple motivation. It is a professional league with professional players, okay, who do this all day long. Strategy, tactics, and culture matter, okay? Those things matter, and those things weren't aligned properly in order for this group to maximize its abilities. As we have discussed, this is a good roster. It may not be a great roster. It is a good roster. It is substantially underperforming, okay?
Yeah.
And the players have to wear it. The players have to wear it. Mm-hmm. But I think there's more going on here than simply not being able to push buttons. That too many guys on the team were too... I mean, I don't mean to jump around too much. I do think that there were some interesting comments made by Andrew Kopp, who I've learned to like and hate a lot more this week. But anyways,
we'll talk about... He's a polarizing figure now.
He is really a polarizing figure with some of his cryptic comments on vaccination and testing.
I don't think our political discussions would go well.
No. But we'll set that aside for the moment. And he did talk about accountability. And, you know, I do think that the imposition of accountability was uneven across people. Like, some people got away with anything and played their minutes regardless, and then some, the younger players, more or less, were overly accountable in the sense that, you know, if they made a mistake, they were out of the lineup, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, here's the thing, and we talk about this all the time in football. Culture defeats strategy. Okay, Paul Maurice was here for 8 years, 9 seasons, better part of 9 seasons, right?
Yeah.
His imprint is everywhere in this organization, and it's going to take more than a practice or two to change that.
Right.
Okay? Culture can help propel you forward when it's based on the right things. It can also be toxic when it's based on the wrong things. Okay? It can be like a cancer. Every team has a culture. Every organization has a culture. You can't escape it.
Yeah.
And what you have to do is carefully cultivate it so it works for you and not against you. Because once it's ingrained, it's really, really hard to change. And I think that's the lasting legacy of Paul Maurice, in that the culture hasn't been great. He was here for far too long, and yeah, we've let some of these not... They may not be hyper-negative, but they're not the right things to be able to win at the highest levels in the NHL. And it's going to take time to unwind that. It's going to take more than a couple practices, because culture defeats strategy. You know, I sure hope this team can listen to the messaging coming from the rest of the crew that was left behind after the grenade went off. But, you know, we'll see. And that's my short-term concern, was this was left to fester for too long, that Paul Maurice himself had to do what the organization didn't have the intestinal fortitude to do, which was get rid of him.
So, a lot of good points there. There was an article, and I apologize, as I always do, I'm going to mispronounce his name, and he's the best Winnipeg Jets writer that I think we have going. Murat Atis, am I? You can.
Murat Atis.
Oh, man, oh, man.
Everyone in this room is now dumber for having listened to it. God have mercy on your soul.
I'm going to edit that out, too. No, I'm going to keep it. It's who I am. He had a really good article, I think it was the day before, and it was, if you have a chance, check it out, because it was basically trying to hold accountable Mark Scheifele and Paul Maurice, and his position was that Mark Scheifele gets a lot of minutes, more so than any forward, and perhaps at stages it's not deserved. Now, I know we'll probably have a bit of tete-a-tete here with respect to Mark Scheifele, but I thought some of the points in the article were very well done in terms of, statistically, he pointed out as a two-way player, he's not in the top 60 in a lot of important metrics, that he is a, and I could not agree more with this, that he is a sensational offensive player and does things with the puck, both passing and shooting and puck control, that I think are unmatched by most forwards in the NHL, but that his defensive presence has been and continues to be a sore spot, and something that Mark Scheifele himself identified at the beginning of the season, and to my mind hasn't been addressed nearly the way we would want. The one thing that I will give him credit for is, A, he had COVID. B, it sounds like he has some sort of rib injury that Paul Maurice seemed to want to play him through, which that's another part of his coaching mantra that was always inexplicable, that he would rather play injured veteran guys that he likes than give anybody else a shot. But that's neither here nor there. But the article itself was brave to a certain extent, in that because I think a lot of the mainstream sort of Jets media, and I get it, is that you depend on access and you depend on having and forging good relationships with those in the organization in order to do your job. So sometimes I think it's very difficult to be critical or take a critical eye on some of the players and coaches and personnel that you, you cover. And again, we said this right from the onset of this podcast, we wanted to be a bit of that bridge, right? Is that we're not beholden to anybody. Exactly. And we can and will try to be as responsible with the platform as possible, but that we can take, you know, and I do it. So we can be critical. And I think the article itself was a good one. And I know he got some messages saying that maybe he was the harbinger for Paul Maurice's resignation. I don't think he has that level of power, but I read it and I was like, wow, if I'm Paul Maurice and I read that, that's something I would take to heart. And you mentioned it, part of the concern for me is that it sounded like, and again, Maurice admitted in the press conference, was that his heart hasn't been in this for years. Yeah. The COVID experience was really hard for him, but that it's been years since he really enjoyed coming to the rink. And I'm not saying this is causation or even a direct correlation, but how long have we been referencing that perhaps Paul Maurice is not the right person for this job? Well, 2 to 3 years. Yes. It was evident to us, and we're not experts. I don't get paid. And so it seems to me I can't.
Well, we don't get paid a lot. I've earned $2.04 as a podcaster.
Sorry, I forgot the gumball money you're getting.
Gumball money, yes.
But it's odd to me that those within the organization, both ownership and the GM, didn't recognize this. And the thing that got me in his press conference, he had mentioned that he had had these conversations at the beginning of this year, what his future was and whether or not he was the right person for the job. And he still was not replaced. Like, I have a feeling, and this is just a theory, I'll put my tinfoil hat on, but I gather from Chevy's demeanor during his press conference that I don't think he's going to lose a lot of sleep over this decision. I think this is an ownership position. I don't know if it's Chipman or Thompson, but I think they believe that the culture of this team is that everybody stays. We're going to build a family and we support our family. And, you know, we saw that with Cheveldayoff and the ownership support of him through that, you know, through that shitstorm, for lack of a better term.
Yeah.
And I think the sentiment was the same for Paul Maurice, is that he's our coach for as long as he wants to be our coach. And that's not how you run an organization. That's not how you run a successful organization. And I don't have one scintilla of proof or evidence of that. It's just speculation. But Chevy was openly disagreeing with Paul Maurice at times, especially in the playoffs at the end of last year, in terms of the personnel that we were playing. I think Chevy had a very strong desire to get some of our young guns in there, which obviously never happened and is a trademark of a Paul Maurice run team. But it is something where I think the fact that that Paul Maurice had to come out and resign himself gives me pause, and real pause, because I don't think that should have been the case.
Yeah, well said. There's a lot to unpack. There are a couple things I want to comment on, and good on you for bringing up Murat's article, because it's really, really good. Yeah. I do think professional journalists do have a very difficult job, and from a very selfish point of view, a lot of what they do just doesn't do it for me, based on the constraining factors around their job, and you mentioned it, the access being one of them. Now, this was an actual piece of journalism, right? Because it was informative and dispassionate at the same time. I'm not saying he didn't care about his article. What I'm saying is it's a fact-based approach to analyzing was going on, and it helped me better understand the what I was watching and what I was experiencing as a Jets fan. He took numbers and made arguments supported by numbers to come to a conclusion, and was able to identify some of the hypocrisy isn't the right word, but a duplicity in what Paul Maurice was feeding the media and the fans all the time. So we have, and it was a Charlie horse, I think, is what he alluded to as Shifley having. So then he simply asked the question, if this player, in this case, Shifley, and in the past it has been applied to other veterans, if they are suffering from an injury, and that's a card he likes to play at the very last moment, well, hang on a minute here. This guy isn't playing very good. Oh, well, he's injured. He's fighting through. And I guess maybe in past, that was enough for the reporter to go off and say, and write a positive article about the player because he's so loyal and committed to the team, he's fighting through an injury. So, but now we're in the age where we have access to numbers where we can ask the question, okay, if he is struggling through an injury, and that helps explain some of these numbers, why is he the number one center? Why is he getting number one center minutes? Now, if we are in a situation where Brian Little is on LTIR and we have no second line center, right, which was the case for a while, you're kind of forced to push Shifley into that, you know, 22 minute a night role, I get it. But now we have a legitimate, now we can argue whether, you know, whether Dubois is a number one center or number two center, it doesn't matter. You have another guy that is absolutely driving play, who is healthy. No one said he's hurt, and yet he's getting 18 minutes tonight, and your injured Mark Scheifele is getting 22 minutes.
Doesn't make any sense.
Okay, doesn't make any sense. So why not just flip the two? Because, you know, Mark Scheifele's ego should be strong enough so that if he is legitimately hurt and fighting through an injury, going from 22 to 18 minutes shouldn't be too damaging to his ego, right?
Mm-hmm.
You're elevating your players that are playing the best, which by my account sends a positive signal through the dressing room, is that if you play well, you'll be rewarded with more minutes. And so, you know, I thought it was a really compelling piece of journalism. It wasn't an article. It was journalism, because it simply wasn't just, a written article of the echo chamber that's happening at the press conference. It actually took words and data and analysis. It included analysis. Okay, so I thought it was just an incredible article. And, you know, if Maurice is 99% of the way there, he reads this article, and Murat is such a kind soul.
Absolutely.
Like, he reads that article and he says, okay, that gig's up. Now, of course, it didn't take Maurice from 0 to 100. He didn't just wake up that morning and go, okay, I'm quitting because of this article. But of all the things, of all the complexity around his decision-making and his experience, and then he reads that article and it's just like, all right, they're starting to turn. I saw this in Carolina. I saw this in Toronto. I know where this is going, and it doesn't get better. Because I think the media is somewhat like the room. When you lose them, they're like a pack of wolves, and they just turn on you. And so he saw this coming. One of the interesting things that came out of the press conference was, Maurice resigned, Cheveldayoff indicated he's going to be taken care of going forward.
Right.
Well, if you resign, you know, you're walking away from your contract, right? If you get fired, which is why some of these coaches try to get fired, you get paid until your contract is up.
Yeah.
So I think there was probably, I suspect, I have no evidence to prove this, that there was a conversation where Cheveldayoff expressed his, I'm sure he wasn't at the point where you're going to get fired, but it's like, hey, buddy, there's a lot of bad things going on. How are you going to fix them?
Yeah,
stuff's going bad here. I need a game plan as to how we're going to get out of this. Well, you know, da 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 da. What if you give me the opportunity to resign and save some face, you know, I will do that, providing you honor the rest of my contract. Boom, done. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I would surmise that that's how it went down. Is that it was a bit of a mutual conversation in terms of kind of like negotiating a deal, right? Where I'm going to do this, you do this, great. We're both in alignment. Perfect. So the first thing I thought when I saw that Chevy was going to make sure that he was sort of quote unquote taken care of, I was like, well, that doesn't happen when you quit.
No.
Especially if you disagree with the person who's quitting, you do everything you can. An organization that as at max cap levels would probably relish the opportunity to save a little money. And so I 100% agree that I think that's the way things went down. And I don't want to... I had prepared a little bit of a... Well, here's why I think at the end of the day, Paul Maurice made the right decision. And here are some of the things that he has done or did that led, I think, to the underperforming position that we're in right now. But also, conversely, I'm not a fan of kicking someone while they're down.
No,
and I've written articles, you've written articles, we've been very vocal on this podcast. Anybody with a Twitter account can go and you could really go down a rabbit hole in terms of some of the animosity that is out there for him. I mean, it's to a job done.
Kudos, Elaine, on a job done.
Yeah.
And I think it's something where I hope that he takes some time, maybe does some broadcasting. I don't know. What are your thoughts? I don't think he's going to get another coaching job. Maybe I underestimate the naivete of 32 other NHL GMs, but I can't imagine that anybody would look at sort of the 8 years of this and say, yes, this is someone I want in a changing market and in a changing more analytical professional league. But if he does, again, I wish him all the best.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's really hard to move forward when you're staring in the rearview mirror. And so this was about moving the team forward, not about punishing Paul Maurice.
Right.
He's a bit of a, in my view, is a bit of a retrograde view on hockey. So I don't, there's some talk about bringing him back into the organization. I think the very reason why he resigned and there was probably some consternation within the organization as to his performance is the very reasons why you don't bring him back. He's not seeing hockey going forward. He sees hockey how it was played in the 1990s and the early 2000s, and has been trying to replicate that to and largely unsuccessful. And if you take a look at the players that he's sort of hitched his wagon to, and that have done relatively well under him or well under him, those are the players that more resemble the player that existed during that time. And if you look at the players that have struggled or have been discarded through his tenure as the head coach, they're the more the 21st century player.
Patrick Laine,
the, you know, whether it be the Ville Heinolas or the Nick Batans or whoever the case may be, you know, it's those players that are increasingly defining success in the NHL that have been sort of really put through the ringer. So, you know, I don't know how connected he is. This is, you know, a game where friends hire friends. So I don't know. I mean, and based on him, if he's lost the fire to come to the rink, then probably it's going to be a chunk of time
before he gets that back. Before
he gets it back, even if he wants to get it back. You know, he's coached for a long time, which means he's made NHL money for a hell of a long time. I don't know how many cottages you could own, you know, before you're happy, but he's made millions and millions of dollars. My understanding is he was, you know, pretty well compensated as the head coach of the Winnipeg Jets.
I like how you measure wealth in cottages. I think that's your currency. I love it, because I'm the same way. It's like, how many cottages is this guy worth?
Well, is this guy a 6 cottage guy or a 4 cottage guy?
I love it.
It's like a currency of the rich is cottages.
And it's a very Canadian currency of the rich, right?
Exactly.
Because everybody wants a cottage, let alone multiple cottages. And so I love how that's the frame of reference.
When they sit around and they play cards, they like, I'm all in. I'm going in with 2 cottages. Which one? Muskoka or Lake of the Woods? Lake of the Woods.
Awesome. Well, I think, you know, we could go for hours.
On and
just,
on, yeah.
Right, just about where this has taken us. But it did, you know, a lot of this is, and I think part of Maurice's decision was that we, you know, the past 4 games since our last podcast, right at the end of our last podcast, I think we both said that 3-1-1 for our next 5 games would be a reasonable mark and something that we had somewhat expected. We did not do that.
When I said 3-1-1, I was going losses, wins, overtime losses.
Oh, I
put the losses first. Was I not clear?
You. I'll give it to you.
1-3-1.
Yeah.
Not what we were expecting.
Not really. They, you know, and we had some stinkers there. The Buffalo game was basically the nadir in terms of this Jets season. The Canucks game, also not a game that we should lose, albeit in overtime. And the Kraken, 2 things on that one. I thought their barn would be packed and just filled to the brim with enthusiastic Seattle fans. It was empty. Our Todd, who was on the podcast, was at that game. And we were going back and forth, and he was very excited for the Jets. But I asked him, I was like, is it kind of empty? And he's like, it's not even 50% full here.
Wow.
Which is surprising to me. At least the PR movement across the NHL has been that, oh, you know, these are the new greatest fans. But I think you have to actually be in the seats in order to be good fans. Regardless, we took that 3-0. It was a all-around good game, and Connor was doing Connor things, and he had a great game against the Kraken and the Canucks. But at the end of the day, the loss to the Sabres was, to me, it was my breaking point. I was like, I can't do this anymore. Like, there's nothing else to say in terms of what we can and can't do as an organization. And so a change has been made. And that change happened right before the Capitals game, which I thought we acquitted ourselves pretty decently. The stats somewhat back it up. There were still lapses, and the Capitals weren't at full strength, so we should mention that. But I thought there were periods throughout the game that we looked really good, But as we always do, we had lulls, and lots of them. And those were times where the puck ended up in the back of our net. And you referenced it earlier. One practice, and Dave Lowry mentioned it too. I can't make a bunch of wholesale changes in one practice. Yeah. So it'll be interesting to see what we do moving forward. But I did think we didn't play poorly in the Capitals game. But this is something where it's now up to the players. And that's so obvious and such low-hanging fruit. But I have been on my soapbox saying that the coach is an issue and probably the biggest issue in the impediment to success this year. Well, if your coach getting fired, whom by all accounts you admire and respect, and he resigns because his message is, I can't get these guys going, and then you can't get going as a player, and we can't get going as a team, well, that's a huge problem. Then we were basically back to square one, where we might have to start shipping out assets and replacing them with assets that can cohesively turn the ship around. And so I was a little disappointed in the first period of that game that we didn't have more jump, because it's like, if you're not motivated after that, I don't know when you're going to be motivated.
Yeah, it was an interesting block of games. And as we've discussed previously with a high degree of consternation, the Jets are all over the place. Like, in the game they won, they were, you know, Seattle had more high danger chances than we did, right? And then over the next three games, we're pretty good at, you know, generating high danger chances. Again, I'd like to look a little bit more closely at, you know, are they coming from the edge of the high danger chance? Are they contested? Are our opponent's high danger chances uncontested, where they're just absolutely open in the slot and therefore have more time and space to do something interesting? But, you know, statistically or superficially, we're doing enough good things. The puck isn't going in the net. We don't talk a lot on this podcast about Connor Hellebuyck. And
fair.
Obviously, a team will go to a certain extent up and down as their number one goalie does, right?
Yeah.
But I do think, you know, he sure needs to be on, right, for us to win a game. And he was against Seattle. A game where we were probably outworked. Now, apparently Seattle is a super hardworking team.
Yeah.
That's their MO.
Yeah.
And they're a hard forechecking team, and they're a team that has a little trouble scoring around the net. We'll tick all three of those boxes for what I saw in our game against Seattle, right? I felt they outworked us. Again, I don't think we were crap in that game. They outworked us. I think they had some chances around the net where they just kind of flubbed their lines a little bit.
Yeah.
And I do think
they don't have a great deal of talent.
No, they don't. Anyway. But they have more talent than you kind of, like, you're like, oh, I know that guy, and that guy's a pretty good player. Mm-hmm. It's going to take time for that team to come together. Vancouver, I mean, Thatcher Demko has had our number all year.
Crazy.
Really good goalie. And they're a team that is actually benefiting from a new coaching bump. Bruce, there it is, as the saying goes.
I've never heard that.
You haven't heard that? That's what their fans chant now. Bruce, well, there it is.
Well done. Because
their head coach is Bruce Boudreau. Who was recently fired their head coach and brought in Bruce Boudreau, who's really ignited that lineup. And I think we saw that.
Yeah,
yeah, so that was a game where we were able to... We got 37 shots, 14 high-danger chances, but we surrendered 17 high-danger chances on 36 shots. So, you know, that was... Vancouver, I felt, has been an underperforming team. But based on their record, we should be, you know, a little bit better than them. I think they were the better team in that game. And then, you know, I felt we were flat against Buffalo. I'm going to get to the Washington game in just a second. We had 18 high danger chances to Buffalo's 9, and the goal, it was the goalie's first game in the NHL, I believe. And
which is a nice way to lose.
Whoa, I had tickets to that game. I literally picked that game. I thought it was guaranteed win night. That's why I took a game on a Tuesday night in December. But you know, otherwise you're not typically picking Buffalo. Other than sweet jerseys, anyways, they have great jerseys. But though we did have a decided advantage on the high danger chances, you know, I didn't feel that we imposed our will on them at all. I felt that it was somewhat of a lackluster effort. And then my feeling, and again, it was IPA eye test Friday after a staff Christmas party. So I felt I did a pretty good job of, you know, being able to be functional when I was at the game. But
you were good.
I thought I was well behaved.
A puddle when I showed up, but you were coherent. Yeah, absolutely.
You know, I take my IPA eye test Fridays very seriously, unlike the previous Friday, which was a mess. Anyways, moving on. I felt the Jets didn't have it that night, and I was very surprised to learn that they had got 42 shots. They had 14 high danger chances to the Capitals 13. Okay, so the numbers are solid. We had 42 shots. They had 39. So they got a lot of it was a high event hockey, which should be good for us. So it was quite you know, I felt like those numbers suggest that a lot was going on. I felt the game was boring and the Jets didn't have it, that they didn't look dangerous all night, and I was shocked to see they got 42. Now again, my vision was fueled by a few IPAs. Ironically, I was drinking Nautical Disaster from Lake of the Woods Brewing Company. So an appropriate beverage choice.
Side note for listeners, if you ever really want to get under Bond's skin, and this is for his coworkers that are probably now listening, is just walk up to him and say empty net goal. And then get out of the way. Vaughn reacts to empty net goals as he got shot. I've never seen anyone leave his seat, like, because in the Washington game, there's like a minute left, and they scored their second empty net goal. And I haven't seen Vaughn move that fast in 20 years. He was out. And the level of disgust on his face, I was like, okay, understood. Vaughn does not like empty net goals. It was awesome.
Mike, I think it's fair to say I threw an adult tantrum. I don't know. You're right. I mean, what can I say? They bugged me so much. I basically threw an adult tantrum and I stormed out of the rink.
It was a storming.
Oh,
but
shout out to my wife and kids who came and picked me up and saved me from a $35 cab ride to get home. So that was the best.
They're the true heroes. That was really,
they were the true heroes that night. But, you know, I mean, I'd love to hear, you know, you had a little bit more clear-eyed view of the game. And I know that you did allude to it, that you felt that the Jets played well in stretches. So kind of just building on that, because my experience that night, I guess I was just emotionally expecting something so different than what was delivered. Like, there was no passion. There wasn't a lot of body contact. And it's not like I advocate this, but I thought if there was ever a time for someone like a Brendan Dillon just to grab someone, drop the mitts, and try to get the energy up, or Logan Stanley, or whoever, something to get the energy going, like play more like you played against Toronto when there were all these, like, I'm not asking anyone to knee anyone, that's not what I'm saying, but, you know, that night where Pierre-Luc Dubois, Pierre-Luc Home Depot, anyways, Pierre-Luc Dubois basically ragdolled Austin Matthews. I mean, that's going to charge the bench. We needed something like that on Friday, and it felt like, to be honest, maybe the guys were just in shock still.
No, I mean, to whatever credit is due, is that it sounded like, and I also believe this, that they really had no idea, and so I think probably for a lot of them it took them by shock and surprise. But I agree, that was my complaint, is that we just seem flat in a game that, you know, I said it already, that if anything's going to motivate you, it's the coach that you love and respect resigned and basically looked to the players and said, I don't know what else to do, guys. Like, I've done everything I can. We're not good. So let's get somebody else in who can help. And, you know, the first period, and I was sort of called it during the game. First period, we were flat. Second, I thought we were much, much better. And for parts of the third, I thought we played well. And then, as we do, we took our hands off the reins and the Capitals capitalized, no pun intended. And so it was something where I just don't think that it's enough time to process. I'll be interested to see how we come out in our next game. But, I did want to mention, I feel for Adam Lowry, because having your dad as the head coach, that can't be easy. Like, no. I think of the ribbing. They think about when in junior hockey, how much ribbing would go on if a player Their parent,
and he gets the start.
And he gets the start, which was incredible to me. It's like
you read the room, Dad. Read the room.
It was because Lowry never gets the start, and he got the start. So it'll be interesting to see how that dynamic plays out. By all accounts, they seem to manage it very well. And I was saying to our friend Rich that if there's anybody on the team that I think can navigate those waters, I think Lowry is definitely one of them. I think he keeps a good head on his shoulder. I think he has a good sense of humor about himself. I think he's realistic about his game and the expectations of that game. And I think the way he plays the game as sort of a glue guy insulates him from maybe some of the, you know, if he was the star player, you know, if he was Mark Scheifele and he was getting 25 minutes, I think that's a little more tentative. But his role on the team is solid and consistent and has been for years. And so
super defined. He's not going to be playing with Nick Ehlers and Kyle Connor.
No,
he's not going to be on power play one. You know, he's not going to be the captain. He perhaps more so or as much as anyone else has a defined role on the team, and it's not going to shift simply because his dad has become the head coach. So, I mean, there's been a lot of consternation out there. I guess Dave Lowry, when he was the head coach of the World Junior team, had a rather disastrous showing at the World Junior Championship. I haven't looked into that too much. It was five or 6 years ago.
Yeah.
He's probably and hopefully evolved and improved as a coach since then. I think managing an 82-game schedule or whatever's left, a 50-game schedule, is fundamentally different than coaching in a two-week tournament. So I don't think that there's a lot of overlap there in extracting conclusions or hypothesis from what happened in the World Junior to what's going to happen in the NHL. It's two different levels of hockey, obviously. So there was some consternation expressed on social media that, you know, these are the usual suspects, and they're simply there's not going to be a fundamental shift there. And I think it's premature to say that. I do think that, I don't think it's obvious that all the assistant coaches, even a Charlie Huddy, sing from the same songbook as the head coach. I think the head coach sets the parameters for what he wants to see. From the various groups on the team, on the power play, penalty kill, forwards, and defense. And it's the assistant coach's job to coach within those parameters and to implement.
Charlie Huddy is like Mike McDee from Rounders, like hanging around. Kid's got alligator blood. You can't get rid of this guy. Two coaches, however many years, like and would assume has input into the power play and penalty kill. He's like Teflon. Everything bounces off him. And I don't even really know him that well because he's very, you know, not truculent, but he's kind of standoffish and he doesn't say much and he lays awake in the shadows. But I can't imagine moving forward that we can't, like, that's also how these things go. However long Dave Lowry's tenure is going to be, I understand it's interim. So probably next year someone will come in and then everybody will go. So Huddy has a year here to find another job. But I'm just always amazed that he, like, every time I turn around, there he is.
Yeah, I mean,
it's amazing.
I think you hit the nail on the head. It's really hard to pinpoint his contribution or lack of contribution. I do think that there, in the game of hockey, and I'm drawing on my experience as a football coach, is there are some watertight compartments. I don't think it's necessarily, one can assume that he has input on the power play and the penalty kill. I think those are the responsibility of a specific coach who would report to the head coach on that. And the head coach may or may not set the general parameters for what he wants to see on the power play and penalty kill. And then, so the head coach would set the strategy and then, or at least confirm the strategy brought to him by the coach responsible. And then the position coach is responsible for the tactics employed to get results, right? So, it's hard to say at this point how much of a departure this group will. I mean, I think they'll be given wide swath to make any changes they see fit necessary. But at the same time, we just don't know at this moment how much their personal vision and viewpoints on these things will diverge from what Paul Maurice was asking them to do.
Yeah.
It could be, unfortunately, quite similar, and therefore we will get similar results. Or hopefully in a key way, because I don't think we need fundamental reforms across. Well, I kind of think we do. But I do think there is some low-hanging fruit, whereas if we make some tweaks on something such as a penalty kill, right? Changing our view on the penalty kill could provide great benefit to us going forward, because that's been an area that has really hurt us. Ironically, in the last four games, we've only given up one goal on 11 power play opportunities. So
I don't see a lot of change, though. I understand the PR perspective that it was put out there that, yeah, we need to make a change and we're going to be more aggressive. And I saw that a few times where, as a unit, we were more aggressive. But even in the last couple games, I've noticed a tendency that we've fallen back into the sagging diamond formation or whatever we want to call
it. This goes back to my point about culture, right? Those things have been ingrained in them. Like hockey, and I don't mean this in this moment as a negative thing. It's not a thinking man's sport. It's you're out there and you're just reacting, right? You're relying on your training and your habits, and you just react, right? It's not a super a very few players, and they're the elite players, can actually analyze and calculate during what is one of the fastest games on earth, right? Most guys are just reacting and implementing the training that they've got. So it's going to take a long time. And that's what can be insidious about a culture that is not directed towards winning. Like, every culture thinks it's directed towards winning, but winning in the NHL or other professional leagues takes certain things, and you're either directly pointed in that direction or not. And I don't think the Jets are pointed in the direction they need to be to maximize the talent on this roster. So it's going to take time to right the ship. It is a huge ocean liner that doesn't turn on a dime. It's going to take a long time to rechart our course back on a direction to where it needs to be. And I think the penalty kill is one. You can talk excellent. The guys, we're just going to be aggressive. Be aggressive all over the ice tonight. You're tired, right? You're working hard, and you know, so you fall back on your training. And for me, I liken it to the power play. Sometimes, like, they just shoot at the net at from a position on
ridiculous
the ice
angles,
which is absolutely ridiculous. And I truly believe that they're tired and they just forget they're on the power play. They just forget they're on the power play. It has to be, because what they just did makes no sense rationally or intellectually. So I do think that that's where you're talking about instilling that culture. What are their habits?
Yeah.
Okay. Because those habits get reinforced a million times. And then when in doubt, you fall back on your training, right? So if they've been trained to do a certain thing over a long period of time, that's what we're going to see. And it's going to take a long time to get that, to train that out of them. And that's, again, that's the insidious part of having a culture that's directed in the wrong direction.
Yeah, and you know, just real quick on the power play point, I think some of that is also born from the fact that we have sort of a plan A and plan B on the power play. And when those don't work, I think some of the shots are born out of frustration, in that it's like, well, we did plan A and plan B. We're still in no better shape than we were when we entered the zone. I'm just going to take a wild shot from the corner and hopefully it bounces off the goaltender and we can pound in a rebound. Like, and again, to your point, which I agree with, is that that's training, where it's like, we've been trained to look for plan A, which is, you know, either the Wheeler or Shifley cross seam pass, or plan B, which is put it behind the net and then come around and try and find whoever's in the slot. Outside of that, we don't really have any other tricks in our sleeve. And I think they look at it and go, well, it's been a minute. We haven't had a shot yet, so why not this? And again, I agree with you. All that needs to be trained out, where it's like, no, have seven plans and implement them in different ways for different teams based on the strategy that they use on the penalty kill. That's the biggest thing. And again, I said I wasn't going to pick on Maurice, but that was it was a bit of the checkers and chess, is that we were never really playing chess. It was a lot of checkers, where it's like, okay, well, we do this, they do this, we do that. And as you've been harping on, it's reactive, where it's like, oh, if they're going to do this, then we do this. It was never, all right, well, let's be three moves ahead. I already know what you're going to do, so we're going to do this proactively and gain an advantage. And I agree with you, that's not going to happen overnight, but it'll be interesting to see what it looks like in the future. And normally in this space, we do sort of a flight plan and do a bit of prognosticating. But I mean, if you want to give it a shot for the next few games, I'm happy to. But to my mind, I'm almost thinking that I don't have a sense at all how this team's going to react and what the team's going to look like, what the lineups are going to look like, how we're going to, as you put it, sort of begin the untraining, and to what extent that's going to look like in the near future. You know, maybe we run through the games that we have coming up and give it a general thought. I just, I'm more so hurt by my own lack of accuracy, because I think I've been wrong on every single one of these this year. Like, if I say 2-2, they're 4-1. If I say we're 1-3, they're 3-1. I got to get off FanDuel because I suck at this.
Well, maybe what we can quickly do is I'll give about 3 sentences on concluding thoughts on the overarching theme for this podcast, which was Paul Maurice. And then I'll quickly run through our next few games. I sent out a tweet. So many people were commenting on it. You know, I just wanted to say one kind of thing. I think that the Jets are a good team. I think they were underperforming. I think the coach has to wear that to a certain degree. And so regardless of how it happened and what was said and how our feelings are about what were said, this is a coach that wasn't able to take us to the next level, and wish him the best. But hey, this was a move that needed to be done. Now it's on the players. They need to step up and do more, because ultimately it's players that win or lose. Coaching matters, but players win or lose. And I have to say, this is a group of players I like and I think can do really well. In terms of upcoming games, we're recording early on Sunday, December 19th. The Jets play today at 2 p.m., which I completely forgot about.
Yes, I forgot about that too.
Yeah, so, you know, we'll see. It's going to be really hard to predict what's going to go on that game, whether there's, you know, how do they process everything from Friday, not only their coach resigning, but their somewhat curious performance against the Washington Capitals. So that's going to be a tough one. It's also the last game where the arena is going to be at full capacity.
Yeah, right.
Our Tuesday game against Nashville has been postponed.
Postponed, yeah.
We are then in Dallas. I mean, that game's going to go on. They don't stop for nothing in Texas. So we'll definitely play Wednesday in Texas. And then they have a bit of a break. We come back. We play Minnesota on the 27th. That will be the first game where we're playing at half capacity. How they're going to split our 3 seats, we are season ticket holders. We have 3 seats. How they're going to tell us which of those 3 seats is held back and which isn't, I don't know.
Yeah.
But that is the Jets' problem to figure out. They're certainly going to take 100% of my money. I love people online saying, like, oh, this is really going to hurt. No, they're not. I owe them $304.50 every month, right? They're not cutting that in half. They're taking all of my money for the rest of the year, and then I'll have some credit at the back end. So their cash flow is going to be fine. It'll be hurt at concessions, but concessions doesn't make or break a professional hockey league. And then a professional hockey team. And then on the 29th, we'll probably have a podcast somewhere around the 27th, 29th. They have Chicago at home, another half-capacity game. I mean, we're kind of all over the place. Those are all divisional matchups. So in that regard, you know, it's a pivotal 4-game stretch coming up. You know, we got to start making up some ground within our division. We've fallen like a lead weight over the past couple of weeks. We were, last time I checked, which was again some time ago because now I'm scared to look, we were near the top of our division. And now I think we're by the bottom. The good news is there's not separating a lot of the teams, but we need to make a push here. I don't know where they're going to find it from. There's a lot of uncertainty and question marks around the team. We will know a lot more about the character on this team as it is currently configured after the next 4 games. What do you think, Mike?
Yeah, 100% in that. I think that COVID aside, which complicates everything, and I couldn't agree with you more that we're not getting any sort of refund for not going to games, which always tickles me. We're currently on the outside looking in for a playoff spot, which a month ago seemed like almost an impossibility. And I'm almost at the point here where I'm not real worried about the playoffs. To your point, I just want us to get right, and I want to see some changes affected and see what those changes do or don't do as the team progresses. I'll be really disappointed if in the next 4 or 5 games, it's just more of the same. Is that we're good in spurts, We look terrible in spurts. We're a middling 2-2. Even the record itself is not all that important to me. I just, something's got to change, and this was the first domino, and I'm hoping that some other dominoes fall along with it and some changes are implemented. And and if not, then I'm again, like I said, I'm going to be worried because I don't see an out here. Like, you know, Blake Wheeler played really well in that Canucks game before he got injured, which is heartening, but he's going to be out for a while. It's just, we're going to have the Olympic break. It could be a bit of a bummer close out to this season, and I don't want that. So fingers crossed.
Yeah, I do think it's cute you think there's going to be hockey at the Olympics, but hey, we've been going for
I'm an eternal optimist, Vaughn. You know that.
You are. Nothing but optimism coming from us. We've been going for about an hour. I do think that this podcast has been a bit of a, you know, just sort of like a brain dump of processing what just happened. I mean, it is a seminal moment in the history of in Jets 2.0 history, certainly.
Yeah, it's a big deal.
I mean, it's a big deal. So, you know, where the Jets go from now, who the key actors need to be, all those types of things, I think we'll have to save for our next podcast. We're just sort of processing what went on. So what do you think, Mike? I think we leave it there and we pick it up in about a week.
Sounds good. Want to take us out?
Will do. So, fellow travelers, that's it for this episode of the podcast. Thanks for joining us in the Airport Lounge, the official Face-Off Hockey Network podcast for the Winnipeg Jets. Check us out on Twitter at Airport Lounge 55, on the interweb at thefhn.net, with all episodes also available on Spotify, Overcast, and Apple Podcasts. Be sure to come back next week to the Airport Lounge, because the first round is always on us. Until then, go Jets go.